Titus 1, verse 5 to 16. This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put whatever remained into order, and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers, and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. For an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant, or quick-tempered, or a drunkard, or violent, or greedy for gain, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine, and also to rebuke those who contradict it. For there are many who are insubordinate, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision party. They must be silenced, since they are upsetting whole families by teaching for shameful gain what they ought not to teach. One of the Cretan prophets of their own said, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in faith, not devoting themselves to Jewish myths or the commands of people who turn away from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but they deny Him by their works. They are detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good work.
Thanks very much for reading that, and please look down to it. We're looking today, we're carrying on from where we were last week, on the issue of the church in Crete and how to fix a problem like Crete. And the huge issues we saw there. And it means that as we talk about churches, this is going to be a slightly more Church of England sort of talk than it normally is. I've even brought with me the Church of England newspaper, or the Church Times. I'm sorry about that if you are not into church newspapers. You may not have read this every day of your life growing up. And I've brought this particularly because they're at the moment doing a sort of four-part series on the health check of the Church of England. And we're going to look at a few things that they say. We're going to compare them to something that Paul says to Titus and see if we can work out what we should do in England as we seek to reach England with the gospel and change England. The Church Times in particular is the middle of a kind of this four-part series, and they're being unusually realistic, unusually truthful, you might say. Here's some statistics with some kind of colourful diagrams. That's not it, because that one's going upwards. That one that's going downwards. By 2030, there will be half as many people going to church as there were in the year 2000. Half as many. And it's very simple to work out why that is. It's because for every one person who joins the church, four people die who currently go to church. And so all the graphs are going downwards like that. And it is likely to get worse, that, because the people going to church are getting older and older and older. So in 2030, 40% of the people going to a Church of England church will be over 65. And just 10% will be under 30 of the people going to church. And they've done some research into why that is. And it isn't because lots of people are becoming atheists. Number of atheists is going up slightly, maybe as many as one in five now. But mainly it is because younger people, meaning you, no longer in general want anything to do with church because of, they think, a massive shift in moral values. So if you're over 65, then church moral teaching more or less matches what you think is moral. So go home, find someone who's over 65, find someone who is over 65, ask them a list of kind of questions. They and their friends in general will go, yeah, I think the church is about right. But if you're under 30, and since I'm not, you don't need me to tell you this, not only do people disagree with church moral teaching, they actually think it's evil. And that is particularly true in the area of sexual ethics that you'll see from the cards on your chair that we're about to go on and teach on in the next few weeks once we've finished in Titus. I hope you will bring friends. I hope that people will want to come and hear what the Bible says. You'll want them to come and hear that. But we need to be aware that as we do, lots of our friends won't just think, oh, it's weird that Christians think that. They'll think that's wrong that Christians think that. Wrong that Kev is going to say some of those things. And the church times have a solution to that problem. Basically, everyone's stopping going to church because they think that what the church teaches is wrong. They say what the church needs to do is change their teaching. So if saying sort of this, what the Bible says, means that we are heard as if we're promoting racism, as if it's the same thing as kind of promoting something like racism, which is what the Archbishop said this week, then Church Times says we must change what we teach, obviously. There is a very simple, very clear program for the next 50 years of the Church of England. We're facing meltdown. The younger generation hates us, hates what we teach. So we must adapt to the new morality and change. And there's always a danger of reading our age too closely back into a Bible situation. But I hope you'll see as we look down at Titus that the letter Paul wrote to Titus on Crete strikes me as very, very helpful in our situation. So we said last week that Crete was famously immoral. 1 verse 12, look down at that again, is a quote from a poet, but it summarizes what everybody knows is true about Crete. Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons, and this testimony is true. That's what everybody knows is true about Crete. And some of the detail may sound very, very like London. They're into freedom from restraint, especially when it comes to sex. They're into greed. And that's what they were known for, as sort of greedy pirates in the middle of the Mediterranean. And that works out into their business and their politics, then just as it does now. And the only real difference, actually, is in the different direction of travel. So Crete had been famously like this for hundreds of years, whereas we live in a culture where things are changing very rapidly. We still have all the kind of issues of strict headmasters that we remember and kind of church being important that some of us remember. But in Crete, just like in London, just like in the Church Times, people in the church looked out at the morals of their cities and realized that nobody was going to thank them for teaching God's standards. So they came up with a plan B. And the second half of our reading tonight is all about their plan B. And we'll get to it when we get to verse 10. But if you want the summary version of plan B, compared to the real gospel, it is more religious and less moral. More religious and less moral, which to me feels a whole lot like the Church Times' solution to our issues today. So we really need to hear Paul's advice to his man on Crete, to Titus. What would Paul say, for instance, to the new archbishop of a crisis-hit church on a small island that doesn't care much about Bible morals? Well, we don't need to guess. The first thing he would say is our point one on the handouts, and it is the absolute need for teachers. This is verses 1 to 5. And last week we looked at 1 to 4 and we built up a summary statement that went something like this. God's gospel truth, as preached by Paul, is what leads to public godliness. Paul wants Titus to have total confidence that preaching the gospel can change people, even on Crete, even in your office, even in your hall of residence, we said. Anywhere you go with the gospel, it can change people, lead to godliness. If Cretans are always liars and evil brutes, well, that's okay. Because all you need to do is teach Paul's gospel, and all the power you need is there to make Crete the godliness capital of the world. We'll see in chapter 2 that really is his goal. Let's make them the godliness capital of the world. So the equation under point 1 is where we finished off last week. This is for math students. Here we go. So truth leads to godliness. Therefore, godliness is in the hands of your teachers. See, faced with the ungodly mess of Crete and the kind of, you might think, not maybe the job he'd have applied for, let's try and get the gospel into Crete. You really want me to go to Crete? Thank you very much, Paul. Well, the first thing he's told to do is in verse 5, is put things into order. How? By appointing elders in every town. And we'll look at them in more detail under point 2. I couldn't decide quite what to call them. Elders is the word in verse 5. Overseers is the word in verse 7. But I went for teachers because that is the only thing they're actually told to do here. is teach, verse 9. The others are about who they're to be. And if teaching the truth leads to godliness, then the thing you need to do, Titus, is appoint teachers. And the shape of verses 5 to 16 is a contrast between the good teachers, verses 5 to 9, and the bad teachers, verses 10 to 16. And your godliness is in the hands of those people. Crete's salvation and godliness depends on who Crete listens to. England's salvation and godliness, or Singapore's, or France's, or wherever you're from, depends on the hands of its teachers, depends on who is appointed as teachers in the church. Because gospel truth is so central, so there is an absolute need for teachers. And if I'm being honest, I think 10 years ago I would have stumbled saying this, because I'm a church teacher, that's my job, that's what I'm paid to do, and it isn't very English to stand up and say my job is very important. But I don't know what it is, whether it's because I've grown up, or whether it's because I've got a clearer understanding of the crisis in this country, or at least in my denomination, I've been surprised to find there's not very much of that embarrassment left. Teachers are absolutely needed. The church will not survive without them, and without them, London will not be changed. And with them, with good teachers, even somewhere like London could be turned on its head and made godly. That is Paul's first priority for Titus. The teaching of the gospel is the whole aim in this book, and you need to appoint people who will do this. It's the kind of attitude the emergency services have. You know, it's not egoism when a lifeguard asserts her priority on a dangerous beach. That's just essential. One of many, actually, alarming moments I've had in my car came the time when I stalled permanently in the fast lane of the M6 in the middle of Birmingham. And the police officers arrived really very quickly, which was good. And they did not hold back out of false modesty. They said, get off the phone, put it in neutral, steer that way. And they pushed me off onto the hard shoulder and saved my life. And at no point did I think they were kind of doing down my status as a history student. You know, I'm a student, you can't. Or getting a bit carried away with their own self-importance. They had a job to do that was absolutely needed. Without them, this history student's Mini Cooper was going to be flattened by one of the half-awake Audi drivers doing 85 coming up behind us. Then they'd have to shut Birmingham for half the weekend. There was a need. Their job was what was needed. It was absolutely important. If preached gospel truth is what leads to godliness, then teachers are essential. And you have to say that is not where the Church of England, at least, has been putting its energies. I had lunch with a senior official last week who told me the average age of somebody starting my job now, that is somebody kind of coming out of Bible college into a curacy or an assistant minister type job, the average age of someone in that role is 48. 48 for someone starting that role. Which tells you a few things. It tells you that Kev is ridiculously far too young to be in this role, even though he's older than Jesus. But he's far too young. But it also tells you that most people see this as a retirement. See it as something to do after you've earned your money and had your kids. It also tells you that as well as a congregation crisis, there is a clergy crisis. You cannot fill all the jobs on people who start at 48 or older. For a while that's been hidden because there were loads and loads of unpaid and retired clergy willing to serve churches a day or two a week. But those people now are getting older and older and older, just like everybody else in church. And there are not the replacements coming through. Do you know how many full-time clergy there are under the age of 30 in the country? Do you know how many? There are 100, slightly fewer. Which means that if 10 people here under the age of 25... and decided tonight to go into full-time ministry in the Church of England, and it would take about 5 years, get you through the system, things went okay, then you would be 10% of the people your age in the entire country. Isn't that staggering? We have a crisis. Not, of course, that we know how many of these people in Crete were in full-time ministry, probably not many initially, though clearly that is what Paul did whenever the cash was available. But the Church of England at the moment has enough cash, more cash than is good for it, probably, and it is able to pay anybody who'd like to, within reason, or not, maybe not so many limits, really, to do that full-time for the rest of their life. And there is an absolute need and an absolute crisis and shortage. Truth leads to godliness, therefore teachers are absolutely needed. Okay, so if that's the absolute need, point two, what Titus needs to do is appoint above reproach teachers of the word as taught. So do you see, the first half of our passage, verses 5 to 9, is on the kind of teachers that we do need. They're called elders in verse 5, which is the word that we get Presbyterian from, for those of you from Presbyterian churches, and overseers in verse 7, which is the word we get Episcopal from, for those of you from churches with bishops, which suggests, doesn't it, that Paul doesn't really care what you call them, whether you call them elders or presbyters or ministers or bishops. He can switch interchangeably between those two words because those two different words carry the same sense, equivalent sense of stewardship and authority. In an ancient culture unlike ours, being old and being an elder carried respect with it. And an overseer, I guess that one's pretty obvious, oversees things. And we're not going to talk about it particularly tonight, though we might next week. But the sense of authority in the role is why Paul can assume without arguing for it that the people Titus looks for should be men, not women. It's not something the passage spends time on. I'd be happy to talk about it more at the end of the series in question time. But the sort of people wanted are the sort of people who are heads of households in their culture. The job is a kind of head of household role. Kev is the head of this house, if you like, is the kind of thing we're talking about. And we'll come in chapter 2 to more detail on how households work and why men and women should have different roles in households. I hope it's okay to park that one briefly till next week, and we'll talk about it more then. It's also clear, though, that this isn't really all about hierarchy and authority. The bishop, verse 7, isn't seen as ruling over the other elders. You might want to have an elder who rules over all of Crete. That's sort of what Titus's role is. But there's no fundamental difference between the two roles, elder or bishop or overseer. The interest here is on two areas that I've put on the handouts. And what he must be and what he must teach. So what he must be, first of all, the key repeated idea is there in verse 6 and in verse 7. We need somebody above reproach. Verse 7, they must be above reproach. And in verse 6, we're going to check that they're above reproach at home. And in verse 7, we learn why that matters, because he is to be a steward, as in over God's house. And above reproach is a word they've chosen really, really carefully. Paul's chosen carefully. It is not the same as sinless. This is a list about public godliness. So, for instance, in verse 6, when we talk about the children of an elder, the issue is how open they are to the charge of debauchery and insubordination. The issue isn't, are they, it says they have to be believers, but it's not kind of, do they believe 100% in everything on the creeds? Give them an exam, even if they're 5. The issue is, are they publicly discreditable? Is this man's household a disgrace? Or is it godly? Every person in any kind of church leadership is a sinner, just as every Christian is a sinner. But if the truth leads to godliness, then you need to be looking for a sort of minimum level of normal public godliness in anyone you consider for the role. There's nothing you see on this list that doesn't apply to every single Christian. I don't know if you thought that as it was being read. If this is the kind of special thing for elders and ministers, how come none of them are special? They're all just normal Christian things. Several of them appear elsewhere in the letter addressed to everybody. And again, with apologies for so much Church of England stuff this week, the bishops of the Church of England, they have tied themselves in knots this weekend trying to explain this. So this weekend they've issued a statement about homosexuality, and they've been trying to say two things at the same time. They've been trying to say that clergy shouldn't have gay sex, while at the same time trying to give the impression to the country that they're entirely relaxed about everybody else doing whatever they want in that area. They've been trying to say both those things at once. And almost everybody who isn't a bishop can see that that is an inconsistent mess. Godliness is godliness. If it's wrong for elders to be arrogant or greedy, then it's wrong for everyone. And the standard here is just designed to say that elders must be at least as good as we expect of everyone else. There must be no public scandal about them. They mustn't undo what they teach by the way that they live. It's not to say that there are sort of two tiers of Christians and two tiers of godliness. Which means, as Titus is faced with trying to put Christian leaders in every single one of the cities in Crete, well, he needs to ask these kind of questions. So verse 6, he needs to ask them about their family life. It says, husband of one wife and his children believers. One wife, that means much more than no bigamists, please. You'll see in the footnote, it's a phrase that means a man of one woman, which means I don't just need to consult my photo album. Kind of flick open to 11, 12 years ago and say, how many women were there in the white dress? Oh, one. Brilliant. I'm in. I'm sorted. I need to ask myself whether I am genuinely a one-woman man. Am I above reproach in my marriage? And this, of course, would apply to unmarried elders or to potential elders. Paul wasn't married. We'll be getting to singleness, I see, at the end of the series that's coming up. Paul recommended being unmarried like him. He definitely doesn't think that's a bar to leading a church. But it does mean that Titus must ask about behaviour in the bedroom or sexual behaviour, wherever you do that. The private life of a potential elder for Crete tells you whether they are somebody applying the truth to themselves and whether that is producing godliness in themselves. Same sort of thing with children. You look at their family, you say, is this someone who's applying truth to their family and producing godliness? My children, as you'll see on the weekend away when they come, are, I think, the worst behaved in any church I've ever been to. But actually, that just means they kind of, at St. Helens, they climb on the tombs and they shout a bit. What we're looking at here is Cretan culture, always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. If you're considering a man whose children are regularly hosting orgies at their house, probably he's not the man for you. We're looking for somebody to lead Cretan people out of their famous life of immorality into godliness. Well, if the bloke's got kids, let's see how they're doing. See if they can teach the truth to their children and produce godliness. Then verses 7 to 8 head off into our relationships with other people. And they are all just sort of basic godliness things. It's a list, so we're not going to go through them all one by one by one. Several of them seem to kind of emphasize the Wild West nature of Crete. The greedy for gain thing is a particular Cretan problem. It's the thing that in verse 11 the false teachers do wrong, part of their reputation. And again, as we go down the list, we're not looking for sinless people. Otherwise, Titus would choose nobody. Be, oh, well, Paul, I tried. There was no one, so I got back on the boat and came home. When I'm talking to people about whether they should be in eldership, leadership of a Bible study group, or leadership in the church in future, one question I often say is, what would happen if we went and asked all your non-Christian mates? In fact, sometimes that is just a really helpful thing to do. And so we'll get through your mates and we'll say, what do you think of this person and the way they try and live out their Christian faith, where you see them at work, where you see them in the bar on Friday nights? Do you see how that protects us from both dangers? We're not looking for sinlessness, because your friends won't see whether you're sinless or not. And I can't see whether you're sinless or not. What your friend sees is whether you are regularly drunk, week by week by week, and no different to them, or whether actually you're a human being with failings, but who is trying to live out what they think, who says to them, actually, you know what, I'm not going to have another drink. Do you know what, I'm not going to make that deal that way. I'm not going to say that on the phone to a client, because there's somebody trying to live in godliness. And personally, going through this list, there's always a few that stand out, maybe a different one each time. Arrogance has been, I think, something I've been battling out for a long time. love of money, I think as I get older and as I have children to look after, that becomes a stronger and stronger temptation. And discipline maybe stands out in particular. And I guess that would be normal for any church leader anywhere to have some on this list that stand out. But the question is, am I currently, and this is something we ask everyone in ministry every year, is there anything in your life currently that if it was discovered would be a scandal to the gospel? Are you above reproach? The sort of thing we talk through with everyone who were thinking of making a small group leader. Is there anything in your life that demonstrates you don't live by the truths you're going to be teaching? In this country, at least, here's one thing not to be so miserable about the Church of England, with the exception of some areas. In general, the Church of England thinks these things are important, but there's always somewhere worse off, isn't there? I know there's several Americans in the room, so here's a story from America. A friend of mine led a church in America in a denomination that was heading very quickly towards total liberalism and the sort of thing the Church Times is recommending. And they had to choose a new bishop, which you think would be a kind of serious, important time. And they said to this guy in his church, do you know what, we're going to have a service the night before, why don't you bring a Bible reading and someone from your church can read it? So they thought, this sounds like a good idea. And a wonderful lady in his congregation, without knowing anything about church politics whatsoever, with no experience outside of her good Bible teaching church, just picked a passage. She went, wonder which passage. And I actually don't know if it was this one or the one in 1 Timothy 3. But she just picked a passage about choosing bishops. Seems like a good idea for a service just before you choose a bishop. And that she got up to read it, and that she began reading out, a bishop should be. And as she was reading, every now and then she had to kind of stop because people were laughing. Around the room there were people kind of nodging each other and going, what a ridiculous thing to expect someone to be. Because the things on this list, not arrogant or quick-tempered, not a drunkard or violent, not greedy for gain, hospitable, lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy and disciplined. They're just normal godliness things. But unless they're insisted on, quickly they disappear. And I could take you round and to visit people whose lives would shock you, who are in ministry and don't think there's anything wrong with that. Godliness, it really matters, because these people have to stick to, hold up the truth in Crete where nobody does. Okay, let's keep moving because time is running out. What he must teach is in verse 9. The character trait is hold firm, which isn't the same as saying this is someone who must be kind of black and white by personality, 100% sure of everything. This is about loyalty and reliability. The things that you've decided are true, you will teach and stick to, even in Crete, even in London. And again, the Church of England has got itself into a crazy place on this, where we're now only insisting that you will mainly teach publicly the kind of things the church says it believes. Doesn't matter what you think in private. And that's never going to work, is it? When you look at what you've got to do with this truth, you've got to be able to give instruction enthusiastically and also rebuke those who contradict. And notice the content really matters. It's the trustworthy word as taught. We said some of this last week, so I won't repeat it, but it's Paul's message. The message that Paul passed on from Jesus, that's found in the Bible, that's the one that Titus is told. Choose people who will teach that message and not move on from it. It's interesting, the part two of the review of the Church of England is about the clergy. How good are they? You may think you've got lots you might want to throw into that report about the ones that you suffer under here. But it's interesting, in that report, the only mention of doctrine, the only mention of kind of the content of their teaching, is in a short sentence where it says it doesn't seem to make much difference to church growth what they believe. No idea at all that it would matter what somebody believed if we're considering them for ministry. And the purpose is that they'd be able to positively instruct, because it is this truth that will turn Crete on its head, will bring salvation and rescue from sin and godliness to Crete. Do you see it's called sound doctrine? When I was a student, sound, I'm not sure we really knew what the word meant. It was like a kind of head-butting badge. You know, so you're unsound because you believe something that's wrong. It's a word that means healthy as opposed to diseased. That's quite a gruesome image, isn't it? you really want someone. If you're going to see the doctor, you want someone who will fix you in a way that will make you healthy, sound. You don't want someone who will pour a load of disease in. I know how inoculations work, but just you want someone who will make you healthy. Teaching matters that much. And there needs to be someone who can rebuke those who contradict it. Which, again, just makes obvious they need to really believe this. They've got to go to someone and say, that is wrong. Stop teaching that. You need to really believe something to be able to say it. I think as a generation, we find that particularly hard. So what do you think after point two? This is going to be very hard, isn't it? You can imagine everybody above a certain age at Crete kind of thinking, oh, wow, as Titus has got to appoint some of us in every town to do this. Kind of nervous, particularly given the kind of bar-brawling culture that Crete comes from. They're looking at each other thinking, really, some of us? Yes. As the gospel changes people, so Paul assumes there'll be people like this in Crete. Will it be difficult? Yes. But the need does not go away. The need is absolute. So in every city, fill the roles with people from Crete. Not that we keep needing to go to other countries to see where this happens, because in Crete we have a complete example of the opposite. So the other thing they have to do, Titus has to do, is rebuke the deceivers, verses 10 to 16. This is what it looks like when you get the opposite of the men in verses 5 to 9. And it is very, very negative. I've put rebuke the deceivers. You can see verse 11, they're to be silenced. Verse 13, they're to be rebuked. And I think there is a simple question here for us to think about. See if we'd answer this. I know several of you go out and after the service carry on chatting about these things. Here's a question. Do you believe in false teachers? Very straightforward. So you might say, do you believe in God? Do you believe in Jesus rising from the dead? Here's a piece of teaching that is all over the New Testament. I wonder if you believe in it. Do you believe in false teachers? Do you think there is any such thing? It's a question I keep asking people in my job, particularly evangelicals in the Church of England. Seems like lots and lots of us have decided, yeah, there's disagreement, but most of that's positive, isn't it? That's how you find out what we really think and, you know, constructive discussion. Do you really believe in false teachers who are dangerous enough to need silencing and rebuking? And just to notice, our culture finds disagreement really difficult, finds saying that you're wrong almost impossible, and finds saying, not only do I not respect your point of view, I want you to stop telling people it, leave your job, stop teaching this. That for us is almost impossible, isn't it? Try saying that to someone in a room, any other human being. And yet that appears to be Titus's job. And verse 9, the job of the church elder. And he goes pretty quickly through their character, insubordinate, empty talkers, deceivers, or verse 16, detestable, disobedient, unfit for any good work. And he goes so far as to say that these people in the church are basically just Cretans. So verse 12 is a proverb about Crete's worst reputation around the world, but he puts it right in the middle of this section on what these church teachers are like. Basically, you live the same way as Crete. Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. Therefore, rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith. And again, I think that just is, isn't it? Half of the Church Times' suggested attack for the Church of England. Let's become Cretan. Let's become like London. It doesn't matter what the moral change is. Obviously in Crete, you walk into Crete and say, you know, it's time to finish with the lying. It's a way of life. Everyone's going to turn on them for that. So the plan B is, let's just adapt. Let's just fit in. Bit of lying's okay. Paul says, no, that needs to be silenced. We get a bit about what they teach. They're from the circumcision party, which suggests a Jewish background. That comes up again in verse 14. Looks like they've been into Jewish myths and the commands of human beings. Which means verse 15, he has to talk to them about purity. And not maybe from the angle you'd expect. They're into kind of adapting to Cretan culture. You'd think maybe they're just immoral and irreligious in every area. But verse 15, he needs to talk to them to say, actually, you know, things are pure if you're pure. It's only if you've got a weird conscience that you're really fussy about whether things are pure or not. What's going on there? I think it means they're really into ritual purity, particularly Jewish Old Testament law, ritual purity. Do you see why I said at the beginning they're more religious and less moral? Obviously, Paul can't mean the kind of things in verses 6 to 9 don't matter. All things are pure, sleep with who you like. It obviously can't mean that. It must mean things coming out of things like circumcision, things like it really matters what you eat, really matters about your religious practices in churches. And again, have to say, that's been my experience, kind of wandering around the wilder reaches of the Church of England, that it is the people whose lives are most immoral and not afraid to kind of tweak my tail by telling them about it to try and get a reaction, those are the ones most likely to tell me off for not wearing a dog collar and be really angry about that. Most likely to care most about kind of where you process in church. I don't know if Kev processed properly today. It's interesting, isn't it, how that goes together. Change the morals, increase the religiousness. But you have to say, we can't just point the finger one way on that. Being over fussy on purity things has often been an evangelical danger. Beer is not pure, pubs are bad, going to plays are awful. We'll say more in chapter 2 and chapter 3 about how much we can be in public life. But you can see the sort of serious problems Titus is facing in Crete. This plan B seems to be well entrenched, verse 11, upsetting whole families by teaching these things. You can see the sort of person we need, verses 6 to 9, has to be the opposite to that false teacher. And you can see why you might think, if things are that bad, well, let's give up. Let's head away. Well, no, the need is still absolute. Even though there are people like that in the church who need to be opposed, the need hasn't gone away. Gospel truth needs to be taught. So we need elders to do that. Okay, I want to say just a few words by way of application and then suggest you keep talking about this later on. I've put on the sheet there a diagram that you've probably seen before. I hope you'll be able to talk about it, explain it to each other afterwards. Basically saying that you are not Titus. We cannot go straight from what God said to Titus through to us. That's the kind of dotted line with the big black X on it, as if you're Titus. If you were Titus, then it's very straightforward. Leave here now, go to the travel agents, you need to book yourself a ticket to Crete, and you need to start appointing elders in every town, if you were Titus. You're not. So let's see if we go through Titus, and then through to us what we're looking like. So I think the nearest person to Titus would be Kev, somebody who needs to care about who's appointed to leadership in this church. Maybe William, who leads the church at St. Helens that we were planted from here, he might be a bit more like Titus. And there is an absolute need. So you should really care about whether the people in those roles do their job or not. The state the church brings in is very largely the fault of the bishops and the clergy, but it is also the fault of everybody who's ever sat in a Church of England church and not said, where are the elders like Titus chapter 1? What are you doing teaching that? Everyone needs to encourage people in that role to do that. And then I think the elders then is me and Kev and the small group leaders and the people who make decisions about the money here at the church, that sort of thing. Well, I hope that if you're a small group Bible study leader, you take the list here in chapter 1, take it home this week, and pray through it really seriously. Pray for God's help in those areas. If there are areas where there's stuff in your life that would be a public scandal, then you probably need to talk about that to somebody. Probably need to get some help on it. It means people in that role need to be very careful that they're holding fast to the teaching, spending lots of time studying, thinking, praying, reading their Bibles, working out whether what they're saying really comes from God's words. And it means people in those roles need to be prepared to instruct and rebuke. And I know which of those two things we find harder. And then to everybody, so I think the church, the audience in Titus is very like the church here and now. Well, I think first application is we should be hammering on the door of anybody like Titus to tell them to get on with it and appoint elders. And the Church of England is lumping parishes together, not because it's run out of money, but because it's run out of vicars. So I think anybody here who cares about that should be kind of hammering on Kev's door, saying, here are the 10 people I think you should get into ministry and appoint. My Bible study leader, I think they'd be all right. Go and speak to them, Kev. Why haven't you spoken to them? See, that's a kind of group responsibility, is to care about these things. I think it means you need to support those in this ministry, particularly those like Kev in kind of senior leadership of a church, in particular as they teach and as they rebuke and as they try and silence. The also final thing to say, I think that lots of people here should consider being those people, consider being in leadership of small groups maybe, and maybe of whole churches. I guess that coming into passages like this, you're worried that I'm going to say something like, I think half of you should go into full-time ministry or whatever. Well, I think I'm going to not do anything like that. The need is absolute. You have eyes and brains. You can see what we need at Euston. We need one minister. We need a student worker. We need a women's worker. We need someone to do training. We need a few apprentices. But actually, you can go beyond that. Half of the young people who go to church anywhere in England go to church in London. There are 100 clergy under the age of 30. So anybody who looks down the list in 6 to 9 and thinks, you know, maybe my life is there. I guess if it's not, just become more godly. Pray that you would be. Keep working on your godliness. Anybody who thinks they might be able to teach and rebuke, the absolute need says, think hard about this. All the way through, I've been aware the danger of saying those things is that it sounds like we're saying secular work isn't important or is second best. I wanted to hedge my bets on that all the way through. Would have made this long sermon even longer than it has been. Here's what I think I'll say is come back next week. Next week, where does everyone who isn't an elder fit in? What's the point of that? I mean, this week, just want to leave you with the absolute need. It is preaching the truth that leads to godliness, transformation, salvation. So the godliness and the salvation of our country is in the hands of your teachers, which means very largely it's in your hands. Let me pray, and then I hand back to you. Our dear Father, we praise you that nothing in this world surprises you, that nothing that seems big and troublesome to us seems that way to you, that you sent the gospel to Crete, and you sent someone like Titus there to try and teach the gospel somewhere, even in Crete, and that your gospel is powerful to change, to save, wherever it goes. Father God, pray we would be convinced of that and would make choices to live according to that. Lord, pray for those in leadership here in this congregation. Pray for those considering leadership in the future. Pray for all of us to value the teaching of your word, the trustworthy teaching of your word as taught, so that we could live lives that adorn the gospel and lead to others becoming Christians. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.